This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Thursday, time to talk about all things municipal. And we all may be sitting in gridlock now, but the powers that be are trumpeting news on all means of getting around Toronto, bikes, cars, and even the LRT. So Line 6, the Finch LRT, is opening soon. And given the massive delays, the local councillor there wants it to be free on opening day. A nice gesture. Would it make us forget all the hassles? That's a question. And speaking of hassles, we had yet another no announcement from Metrolinx on the Eglinton Crosstown. They didn't give us a date. Testing is apparently ending. Now, the minister, Pravmeet Zakaria, has kind of gotten in on the act, spreading his speculation, kind of making it known he thinks it'll open either very early in the new year or, who knows, maybe even at the end of this year. Personally, I don't know why anybody even pays attention to this. We'll believe it when we see it. And meantime, speaking of city councillors, another guy, Matlow, who likes to make big announcements, says we need a public inquiry on what happened with the Eglinton Crosstown. So do we need one, or is that just another way to waste more time and money? And meanwhile, there may be peace in the war on the car. Toronto city staff are proposing new multi-million dollar bike lanes that won't infringe on car lanes. So the Ford government says they're down with that. Though I suspect that on this one, it's the pedestrians that will get squeezed. And from the war on the car, are we pivoting to a war on the rich or the reasonably well off? Mayor Chow wants to raise more money by increasing the land transfer tax on so-called luxury properties, that is $3 million and above. That's what a detached house costs these days. And she's proposing this amid a 10-month slide in both sales and prices of real estate. So what do you think? The numbers, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740.
And now, it's time to tune into the town.
And now I'd like to welcome John Burnside, City Councillor for Ward 16, Don Valley East, and former Toronto City Councillors Karen Stintz and Rob Davis. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Okay, well, let's start with this luxury tax on real estate. I'm just wondering, like, what left or right field did it come out of? And I don't know what the mayor is thinking. Is it a case of, hey, look over here because something else is going wrong? Or is it a reasonable idea? John.
Well, I mean, here's the problem. You know, anyone has mobility, especially wealthy people. So you can keep going after those folks. And now you're asking them to pay a land transfer tax roughly four times what the average person is paying. But they can move out of the city like anyone else. My concern is, She hit us with a hammer the last 2 years in terms of a tax increase, and now I guess she's using a scalpel, but she really squandered away the money that has been collected. And that's my concern. And they'll pivot and say, well, sales are way down and the prices are down, and so our take on the land transfer is down. I specifically asked those questions last year at the budget meeting, and I went right up to the chief, budget chief, not Councillor Carroll, on the city side, and said, has this been modeled in? Because things are really slowing down. And it was guaranteed to me that all these things were modeled in and not to worry. So to me, that's not the issue. They'll say it's the issue. The issue is they've squandered our tax dollars.
And what do you think were the biggest quandaries?
Well, I think the some of the contracts have been overly generous with the union. So start with that, and that was a payback to the folks that got her there. And so we can start with that. I also think the never-ending hole of building housing, which is not a municipal responsibility, is the other big one. Like we're throwing, well, hundreds of millions of dollars, the opportunity cost of land we're giving away. And as I've mentioned before, about one in five people who are applying for affordable housing aren't even from Toronto. So we're taking on these responsibilities. We've got little to show for it, but we spent a lot of money, and then the rest of our services in the city suffer.
Yeah, well, I don't see much affordable housing, and Karen, her justification is to put the money in services that people rely on, but we keep getting more and more evidence that people cannot rely on the services, starting with the TTC.
There's no question there's an increasing disconnect between how City Hall is taxing and spending money and the experience of those services from the average person. And, we've talked a lot about the lack of accountability at City Hall and the fact that the mayor has made investments into areas that will benefit a few, but not the broader sector of the city. And when you think about how much money is now going into shelter housing and support, it's getting close to $1 billion. And yet we still have homeless encampments in the parks. When we think about, the fact that the mayor didn't run on a pledge to provide snacks for all campers in the city summer camps, and yet that was a move that suddenly became very critical in the last budget. And so all of these things, and the libraries extending their hours, they're all great, nice to have. But at some point, you need to rationalize your resources, and you can't just keep going back to the quote rich people who can afford it, because the reality is it's not the people that own the homes that are paying the land transfer tax, it's the people who are buying the homes. And so ultimately it just comes off the sale price because people only have so much money. And I would just finally say, why would the city double down on land transfer tax when, as Councillor Burnside mentioned, it is not a reliable source of taxation, particularly at this time when housing sales are down, prices are down, there's general economic instability, and people are not buying houses the way that they were a few years ago.
Well, exactly. And it's this uncertainty and instability. And I don't know, Rob, going back, a while, people really relied on real estate. I mean, a lot of Toronto's growth and prosperity was based on real estate. And that's going to change. And it looks like, City Council is just not, twigging on that.
Well, I want to say a couple of things. You're absolutely right, Libby. First of all, there's so many people in Toronto who are what I like to call accidental millionaires, because in the 70s and the 80s, they bought a home, they struggled. Some of them had not a stick of furniture in those homes. And because of inflation and because of the way in which the market has driven prices up, they find themselves sitting on a little bit of a nest egg. That's number one. These aren't necessarily people who are born with a silver spoon in their mouth. Many of them were born with a rusty shovel because they worked in trades and they did work that many people found a little bit. You got dirt under your fingernails, but they lucked out. They bought a home, and that the value of that home has gone up significantly. Number two, I think this is what I would call the Zohran mandamnification of Mayor Chao's office. This is an attempt to to sort of copy or to follow this sort of trend that Mandami has talked about making the billionaires and the millionaires pay more. And the challenge with that, and I want to go back to this point about the folks who weren't born with a silver spoon in their mouth. The fact of the matter is that people who pay $3, $4, and $5 million for a home, one of the first things they do is they renovate that home. And so the folks that are tradespeople, the contractors, the plumbers, the carpenters, the bricklayers, the tile layers, those are the folks who are going to suffer. Because if I don't have an extra $50,000 or $100,000 in my pocket to make a renovation, then I'm going to scale back that work. I'm not going to have a gardener or have a landscape architect come and do some work. And so when we take money out of the pockets of consumers, we're indirectly taking money out of the pockets of the people that provide services to those consumers. And so, yes, you're right. Our economy is driven in large part, our Toronto economy is driven in large part by real estate, but it's everything it's not just real estate agents and insurance agents and mortgage brokers making money. It's people in the trades who provide services to those homeowners who are going to suffer.
Well, exactly. I mean, just recalling our own situation, my husband and I, so we bought our home at the very bottom of the market. So I guess we're lucky. It's gone way up in value. We've renovated probably four rounds, but when we bought it, it was almost what we would have considered unlivable. There were, much older people who moved out. There were live wires sticking out in places, but we actually got a good deal on the first renovation just to keep people working. And, younger people are used to scenarios from the pandemic where you can't get a tradesperson to come to your house because they're so busy and have such great jobs to choose from. But I suspect that we are headed back there, John. Am I a nervous Nelly?
No, unfortunately, and I don't have much to comment beyond that, but I think you're right, exactly right on that one. I don't think it's going to be pretty in the next little while.
Karen, I was just looking at a caller who wasn't patient enough to stay on the line. People, be patient. Let me give you the numbers out again. I know people have a lot to say about real estate, particularly some of us older people who probably did luck out because of the way that the market was when we were coming up. The number is 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. I remember back in those days, Karen, I mean, real estate, it's what you talk about at a dinner party, which it's actually a little sad.
Well, I do think there is a market correction with real estate that, I think at some level needed to come. But that being said, I don't think that it gives the city permission to put their hands in the pockets of people who are trying and struggling to buy a home. And sure, you could argue a $3 million home isn't a hardship. But, to your point, there's a lot of $3 million homes in neighborhoods that aren't mansions. That's just the price of the home. And we're also seeing this at a time when food prices are expected to go up. Everything around us is going up. Economic instability is everywhere. People are losing their jobs. And at the same time, the city just, trundles along as if, they just need to raise more money to be spending it on services that...
Quite frankly, did we lose you, Karen? Go ahead.
Sorry, quite frankly, I'd say, give me a few less services and let me hold on to my money.
Well, exactly. That seems like a good plan. I want to talk a bit about this city staff proposal for, what is it, $20 million worth of new bike lanes? The province says no problem because it won't impinge on car lanes, but it's got to come from somewhere, John. And I'm thinking it's pedestrians that are going to get squeezed. And we've seen lately a bunch of, unsavory things that can happen to pedestrians who are just walking along.
Well, Libby, like anything in the city, the devil is in the details. But in terms of the two roads that they were talking about for the first tranches, would be Keel Street North and I believe Kingston Road. Well, Kingston Road, the lanes are actually quite wide. It's a very so they could probably shave off a little bit of the lanes to get them back to what the regulation is. They're wider than regulation out there, and they probably have some turn lanes in the middle that could be eliminated. So I know that in my area, on there's a street that they want to put bike lanes on, and it's actually wider than what the ministry requires. So they're able to put bike lanes in, do exactly that, and bring the lanes back to what the average is. So for those two streets, in my opinion, it's okay. It's when you start getting into other streets that are already narrow, then to your point, who suffers?
Well, exactly. Who suffers? Rob, now, LRTs. I don't understand why any person in management thinks that a non-announcement does anything but really annoy people.
It is remarkable to me. From a crisis management point of view, they seem to not be following the playbook in crisis management. They seem to be falling into their own traps. I mean, at the end of the day, the number one question that is going to be asked by every good journalist worth his or her salt is going to be, when is it going to open? And they seem to not be able to give an answer that is, one, satisfactory, two, believable, and three, they don't have to, you know, swallow at a later date because they were wrong. It just baffles my mind that, like even if they gave a date of January 2027 and then opened in June of 2026, people would be happier because they would have under-promised and over-delivered. But they seem to over-promise and continually under-deliver. It's just remarkable to me that they're doing it that way. I would never advise a client to over-promise and under-deliver. They should under-promise and they should over-deliver, and people will be happy and clapping their hands, like the completion of the work on the Gardner.
I would agree with you. I find it all pretty baffling. Karen, do we need a public inquiry on this, or was this just an opportunity for a press conference?
It was just an opportunity for a press conference. But I do think that we need Premier Ford to act a little bit more like City Councilor Ford, because when he was City Councilor, you know, him and his brother had Gary Webster fired because they claimed that the extension of the Yonge University Spadina line took too long. And it was over budget and badly managed. And you know what? It was actually opened relatively on time. It was 6 months delayed from opening. Now we're into 6 years of the Eglinton LRT. So at some point, someone's got to be held accountable. And that's the frustrating part for me. And, you know, to Rob's point, we don't know when it's going to open. We don't know why it's not opening. We don't know how over budget it is. And the indifference that we get from the government that this is not a big deal is really frustrating for people.
Well, I mean, Ford tried to tackle it with one of his popular Fordisms. Like, he stood up and said, "Hey, this thing just drives me nuts," and people can identify with that. But I don't think that's going to tamp it down. John, do you think there's any value to a public inquiry, other than the fact that it could take almost as long as the LRT itself?
Yeah, no, not really. I mean, until we actually have a semblance of what's going on or what went wrong, then going down that rabbit hole doesn't seem worth the effort to me. I mean, I suspect one of the reasons they're being quite tight-lipped is that there are going to be a lot of lawsuits flying around afterwards between Metrolinx and Crosslinx, which is the contractor. I suspect that's one of the reasons. To Rob's point, it's a great point, but if they had to follow his advice, they'd still be in trouble because, you know, maybe the 10-year mark, they said, well, it'll be two more years. Well, we're into year 15, so I actually applaud them for not giving a date. Because they would just, it seems like the evidence is they would just blow past that date and then they would be definitely under delivering.
Well, you know, sometimes people come out right away and say they can't give a date. And I'm referring to this tragic terrible fire where people just before the holidays are out of their homes in Thorncliffe Park, although in terms of loss of life, we're okay on that front, but a lot of loss of property and home. And I kind of applaud the fire chief for coming out right away and saying, we just can't get a handle on this, so we're going to try to keep everybody safe. And the thing that I and a lot of other people are wondering are, how many other buildings have this stuff in them, Rob?
Like, you're reading my mind. It's the question I was going to ask. I think that's what the city should be doing. The building department should be questioning and looking through all of the inspections of every building that's been built in the last 20 or 30 years to find out if this material exists in any structures in the city, and they need to find a way to perhaps remediate what could be a terrible situation. You know, many years ago, I was there the night of the fire at 650 Parliament Street, helping distribute food and games and toys and blankets to people who were sort of sequestered in the recreation center next door to where they lived. And it was a terrible thing for people because they were out for years, quite literally, until the building was renovated and they could come back to their homes. This also speaks to, in my mind, perhaps the lack of resilience of the city in terms of dealing with something like this. You know, what happens if we had two fires like this? What happens if we had three fires like this, where we suddenly have 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 people who have jobs, have apartments, but then are homeless because of a tragedy? It's a big question, and I think the city has to really consider what the risk is that is out there and try to figure out a way to mitigate these types of fires in the future.
You know, I was actually thinking, seeing what the city is on offer, has offered, I was thinking that they were actually doing a pretty good job dealing with people. And they also started talking about tenants insurance. And I bet that that is something that a lot of people who are tenants skip. That's probably not a good thing, because you have to take a little bit of your own responsibility. But am I being too generous, Karen? Because I thought they were doing a pretty good job putting people in hotels and doing whatever they could.
Yeah, they are. They are. And I do think, though, people are really more aware of the need for tenant insurance. So what does that cover? Because, you know, we find ourselves in situations.
Karen, we're losing you.
Can you hear me now?
Can hear you now.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah. No, it's just, you know, the issue is, what does insurance cover for what is deemed to be an accident when it's all investigated? Standing question that could leave people on the hook.
Well, every insurance is different, and you know, obviously the cheaper the insurance, the less it covers. John, what do you think of the way the city has handled this? Again, it's one of the few things where I thought, gee, they're doing a reasonable job.
Yeah, well, this is more about the fire chief, Jim Jessup, who is like literally second to none. Everyone has a great deal of confidence in him. In terms of the all these tenant the boards that they have, I mean, that is the worst job, is being on a tenant board, because people don't, all they do is complain and they don't want to spend more money. So when a tenant board says, hey, we need to invest and fix this or fix that, everyone loses their mind. And, you know, that gets a big no. And then when there are problems, then they said, well, they'll say, why didn't you fix them? In terms of this one, we can do an inventory to see who used particle board and expansion joints. But the very problem itself is that there's no access in there. But I don't know what remedial action you could do ahead of time. And given that the fire chief was mentioning that he's never seen anything like this, and no one in any major city has seen it across North America, I suspect it's a one-off. But even if it's not, I'm not sure what we could do or they could do to make the situation safer for other condo owners who are in the same predicament?
Well, I would think if you're a condo owner, you'd want to know if this exists in your property. But it really is, wow. I mean, it's a problem that nobody probably took into consideration. And it's a scary problem. And I even heard the fire chief say that he said, if they put out the fire, there's going to be huge damage. And I've even heard it said, Rob, that they may have to take those buildings down.
Yeah, this is what's remarkable. And I appreciate what Councillor Burnside is saying. Like, you know, it's not much that you can do, except that you might be able to mitigate risk in terms of insurance. Maybe, and this is going to sound a little bit crafty, maybe you don't want to know before you list and sell your condo because it might actually have to be on the disclosure documents. I think they call them, you know, estoffel and disclosure documents about knowing if there are any engineering problems. I mean, it can affect a lot of people if this is widespread, and it can affect the value of their property. Tearing down the building would be a disaster, financial and otherwise, for these people, because then they would literally be homeless. And they would be financially harmed in a way that they might never recover from. You know, I mentioned that the phrase accidental millionaires earlier in the show. These may end up being folks who are accidentally impoverished and homeless as a result of this fire.
Wow. I hate to wrap things up on such a dark note, but we are out of time. And again, I've got to hand it. I agree with John. To Fire Chief Jim Jessup, because the level of straight talk from him is something that you so rarely see from any kind of public official, and it is so welcome. So thank you, Fire Chief Jim Jessup. But of course, you know, there but the grace of God go all of us. I just feel terrible for these people. So, thank you, Karen Stintz, John Burnside, and Rob Davis. We'll talk again soon.
Absolute pleasure.
Okay. We are taking a break. And when we come back, so the checkered flag is down. It's the holidays. We're all like running around like mad, trying to get as much done as possible. So I'm talking to the author of a very interesting book called Toxic Productivity. So if you think that you are multitasking, maybe you are just overburdening your brain when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, the holidays are upon us and the pressure to get as much done as possible. So do you multitask in order to get through your to-do list? And maybe you pride yourself on it, especially if you're a woman. But there's new evidence that our brains really don't do more than one thing at a time. And actually, when we think we're multitasking, we're just rapidly switching between tasks. And researchers have found that it adds up to 32 hours of brain work in a 24-hour day. So I just realized that I was caught in the same trap several years ago, which is why I am so interested in the concept of toxic productivity. And I'm now joined by Isra Nasser, a therapist and author who just wrote the book on it. Isra, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hi, are you there, Isra?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now. So I'm not sure if you heard my introduction, but thank you for joining us. And
yeah.
What made you look into what twig that you thought, aha, I've got to explore this?
I was going through some of my own personal stuff around achievement and happiness and productivity. And when I went to bookstores to seek some support, I really found books that were very habit-oriented. But as a therapist, I knew that our emotions actually drive our behavior. So I wanted to do an exploration on the emotions that drive toxic productivity, just to understand myself, and that became the book.
Okay, first of all, so what is toxic productivity?
Toxic productivity is the mindset in which you value outcome and achievement over everything else. And you pursue being busy and getting accolades and external validation at the expense of your wellness. And finally, how good you feel about yourself, so your self-worth, becomes dependent on your outcomes and achievements. So you only feel good about yourself if you're getting something or if you're doing something or people are saying that you're great. And in the absence of that, you just don't feel good about yourself. And that really leads us to unhealthy behaviors.
What about this finding that when we think we're multitasking, we are actually just switching rapidly between tasks?
Yeah, so that's called task switching in like neuroscience and cognitive psychology. And, you know, our brain processes information so fast. We cannot even comprehend how fast it moves. And when we think we're doing two things at the same time, actually different neural pathways are firing in the brain for you to go from one thing to the other and then back to the first. And so in real life, it looks like you're doing two things at the same time, but the load on your brain is really heavy when you're trying to multitask. That's why people are irritable, snappy, they can't sleep well. It's because our brain is like working too fast. It's not designed for that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, personally, I realized it. I run a news department, and I'm used to working with, you know, a pile of monitors on and watching like a bunch of different competitors at the same time. And I realized one day when I was in my office with all of that and writing something, like writing a column that required concentration, that I had no idea what was on any of those monitors because I was focused on one thing. And I thought, aha, I'm not really doing all of that at once when I think I'm doing all of that at once.
Exactly, yeah. And you know, the quality of your work also suffers when you're in like four different places at the same time. But, you know, if your work actually is something that demands multitasking, which I think is for many people, I like to encourage people to then limit how much they multitask outside of work. So try to find pockets in your day where you are just single tasking or doing deep work or being focused on one thing at one time.
Uh-huh. And what about this focus or change to monotasking?
Yeah, so that's the idea of like doing one thing at one time. And you know, so if you're sitting and watching TV, try not to scroll. Or if you're reading, don't pick up your phone. Or if you're talking to someone, you're at dinner, you know, keep your phone aside and just listen to their conversation. And at work, if you have the ability, block off time to just do one thing and put that in your calendar. And, you know, really just like make sure that everybody knows what you're doing, so you're communicating your strategy, but monotasking is the act of doing one thing at one time and really doing it.
Why is it so hard to do that? Because, again, you know, scrolling while you're watching something else, and the worst is, of course, people who start scrolling while you're trying to talk to them. But why is it so hard these days just to do one thing?
We are pulled in many different directions right now. Every single device we have has notifications. Every app we have has notifications. You know, our work doesn't end when we leave the workplace. If we're even going into the workplace, we've got emails and Slack and Teams messages. So we're just we're inundated by information and attention. So we're in what's known as the attention economy right now. Everyone's vying for your attention. And that has made it very difficult for us to be able to focus on a singular task. It's kind of like rewiring our brains, you know, the way we multitask. And that's why it's so hard. it really like makes us feel like we're missing out, that other people are doing stuff or we'll be left behind. And all of those emotions push you to do more and say yes and all of those things.
And so what advice do you have to people who are trying to get back to doing one thing at a time?
Well, like I said earlier, like protect some time in your day to have to really focus on one thing only. Try to limit how much you multitask and really hold yourself accountable. Bring people into your journey, like the people you live with. If they see you scrolling while watching TV, you know, have them remind you gently that, hey, like you committed to not doing that. That's really important. I think like having like unstimulated time is also really helpful. So if you're running an errand or you're walking somewhere, see if you can not listen to music, don't listen to a podcast, don't pull your phone out, and just walk. See what that does to your brain. See how it feels. I think that's really helpful. And one of the reasons we multitask is because we have a lot to do. Right? Everybody is stretched thin. There's a lot happening, especially going into the holiday season. So it's important not to just make to-do lists. What's more important is to prioritize your to-do list. So I encourage people to think through all the things they have to do in a day and really organize them by priority and urgency. And that can actually help you realize that you don't have to do all the things you're doing. You can ask for help. You can delegate. You can take some things off. Some things can be delayed till later. And that can allow you to not feel the pressure to multitask because you're actually paying attention to the things that you have to do.
Okay, I'm going to take a call from Pat in Toronto. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Libby. The question is this applicable to people at all ages? And I'm saying that as an octogenarian. I see too many people who do nothing as they get older, and I think your brain tends to shrink if you do that. So the worst thing, I think, is when men used to have to retire automatically at 65. I used to see them drop dead within a year or two. So is the author's comments equal to people of all ages, I guess, is the question.
Isra, what do you say?
Yeah, I think it's applicable to everyone. I agree that, you know, not being engaged at a mental level is bad for brain health. So the idea is not to do nothing. It's to do one thing deeply. Even at an older age or as you're retired, to really deeply connect to like the book you're reading, the puzzle you're doing, or, you know, the activity that you're engaged in or the person you're talking with. So it's not about not doing anything, but it's about just doing one thing with all of your attention. And that's actually very good for brain health at any age.
Okay. On that note, we're going to wrap things up. Thanks so much to Isra Nasser, author of Toxic Productivity. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, we are taking another break. And when we come back, oh boy, that food price report for 2026. It shouldn't be a shock, but it is. And I want to hear from you people on what you're finding at the grocery store, because what I'm finding is not good. It is very expensive, and I haven't seen this in the report, but I'm finding quality going down as well. So the number is 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-744-740, and we will be right back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, anyone who's bought groceries lately cannot escape the reality that grocery prices just keep going up beyond the rate of inflation. And what I've found lately, especially when it comes to chicken and meat, the quality is way down. Now, Canada's 2026 food price report has put some hard numbers on this, and they're pretty eye-popping. The expectation is that the cost of groceries altogether will go up between 4 and 6% next year, and that will add nearly $1,000 to an average family's grocery bill. And in the last 5 years, if you haven't kept count, food prices have increased almost 30%. 5%. I do not recall another 5-year period where that happened. So I'd like to hear from you people. How have you found this? How have you adjusted to try to make up for it? The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now let's go to Dr. Sadaf Malai, Assistant Professor and Aral Chair in the Business of Food at the University of Guelph, and Rose Reisman, leading health and wellness expert and author. Hello and welcome to you both.
Thank you. It'll be always nice to talk.
Okay.
Hello.
Hello. So, Dr. Malai, when you actually saw the hard numbers on this, were you surprised?
So it is surprising to see these numbers in a sense because it impacts people's livelihood. And the thing is that when you're looking at numbers, the food increase is 4 to 6%, which might not be the highest food prices that we have increases that we've been seeing in historically. But price is just a number. And for consumers, that translates to affordability. And when we're thinking about affordability, it's dependent on budget and it's dependent on so many other factors. For example, wages, housing. So when those other circumstances, they make it harder for people to allocate budget to food, then the food budget is going to be the one that gets squeezed the most, which means that even small percentage increase in food prices will have devastating impact on consumers' food security.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been hearing a lot about food security. And Rose, especially lately when I've been at the grocery store, I have, especially when it comes to chicken, which it has gone up and is expected to go up more, I've seen a real drop in quality.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you say that. I haven't seen the drop in quality so much. I just know that chicken breasts are very expensive. So what I tend to advise people to do is, and it's a little bit of effort, buy a whole chicken and cut it up yourself. You're going to save some money there. In terms of quality, what have you seen the difference, Libby?
Well, I often buy, so first of all, less choice, right?
Okay.
And I often buy bone-in chicken thighs because they don't take too long. Cook them on a weeknight.
Right.
I prefer thighs to breasts because they're a little juicier.
Right.
And, you know, usually there's kind of been a selection, and I have found that, especially when I just, you know, run in to pick something up, the thighs are bigger, so it's like an older chicken, and when they're cooked, they're not as good. Not as good. Like, and they feel, even though it's within the best before date, they kind of, the way they look, they don't look as good. They've been sitting around.
Interesting.
Sorry?
Yeah, interesting. I mean, you know, as I say, I've got lots of tips, you know, for people in terms of affordability. You have to, it's almost like a science, but, you know, some of the ways is like, as I was saying, buy a whole chicken. Also do something called fillers, which is if you're making a burger, have you ever tried using a grain plus beef? So you can cut the beef cost in half by doing things like that. So it's people really developing a mindset saying, you know, I can't afford those steaks anymore. Even the burgers are too expensive. So could you, you know, go to more vegetarian meals for the week? And not all people are open to this, but we're talking about more eggs, more beans, more lentils. And even that's gone up in price, but not nearly
I was going to say vegetables are not cheap. Dr. Malai, we keep hearing that people are pivoting, buying things on sale. You know, even when I'm in the grocery store, some of the sales look like, well, they're not really sales. Why is this price that's put up in front of me more than it was last week? So what about the pivot and the way they're marketed?
Yeah, so we do see this trend of consumers, especially for packaged goods or in general, just going to maybe discount stores or looking for store brands to purchase some food. And then also people are looking into buying sales items, items in bulk. So the because of all the disruptions that we are seeing across the supply chain, prices change. And when in terms of marketing, then that would be a whole different story on how they would promote these changes. But I also wanted to go back to that chicken conversation, because if you're looking at specific food categories, meat prices are said to be increasing in price higher than other categories. And this is a trend that we'll be seeing. Beef was the same last year. And this year, in addition to beef, chicken prices are also going to be increasing because of some of the disruptions across the supply chain. And that means that people who were pivoting to chicken because beef was so expensive need to find another alternative. So I really do like that recommendation of moving towards more plant-based sources of protein, legumes and pulses, and incorporating that into some of the meals that people might have.
Right. And also, go ahead, Libby.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is that one thing we've seen over the last while is people cook less. And kind of if you're stretching budgets and all of that, it certainly helps if you know how to cook.
Absolutely. And I think you have to start doing more prep at home. And it doesn't mean more work. You really have to, you know, make a plan during the week, 5 or 7 days. I always tend to do casseroles, so then I can freeze it into 3 or 4 portions for the next week. Make big batches of chili, soups, pasta sauce, curries. These things freeze well in portions, and you're avoiding any food waste. Other things you can do is buy frozen, more so than fresh, even though frozen's not cheap anymore, but buy seasonal and buy frozen vegetables. They can taste as good if you cook them properly. So these are the things we have to start looking at and changing our mindset, because they say these prices are going to continue increasing to 2027.
I'm going to take a call from Helen. Hi, Helen.
Hi, Libby. Years ago, one of my friends went into the tofu business, and I thought, oh, these are great recipes. Let me try it. And I put about a third to two-thirds of tofu into ground meat. Mm-hmm. And the meatballs were soft and fluffy, and everybody loved them. Till my daughter walked into the kitchen and saw the tofu.
Don't tell them. That's the key.
Well, I didn't. And they loved it. And I even did that with the cheese that I put into cheesecake. Put a portion of tofu in there.
Good for you.
And it was great. However, she saw it.
Yeah. You got to not tell them always and hide it well. But no, I mean, I
lock the kitchen door when you're cooking.
I know. Really hard.
Okay. That sounds like good advice. I mean, tofu, I have to say, is not something that I embrace, but I've never thought of using it that way.
Oh, yeah, it's fabulous. Yeah, it's a great way to do it, even desserts as well. The other thing is buying larger packs at discount stores. Like I will go, you know, to a Costco, buy a large, and freeze it. It is much cheaper to do it than buying 2 or 3 breasts in the grocery store.
You know what? I have to say that I've noticed that even the large packs have gotten a lot more expensive.
Yeah,
and for a lot of us, freezer space is at a premium. You know, not everybody has a great big freezer. Dr. Molai, again, we also talk a lot about replacing things with legumes, beans. Are people embracing that, or they want their, if not beef, then chicken, but they want what they want?
Right. Now, also go to canned fish.
I was asking Dr. Molai.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's okay. Yeah, so we do see this trend of consumers wanting to shift to more a plant-based sources of protein. But in reality, we still have a long way to get to there. And what is important that is there's no, at this point, people might not be ready to do a complete shift, which is completely understandable. So bringing those items such as legumes and pulses into the daily meals as an addition, so then it will reduce the amount of beef or chicken that they're using, and then have these additional legumes and pulses with their food. That is something that is more feasible for consumers. And then also there are some fish alternatives that might be, an alternative that they could be using, and then canned, frozen, some of these items might be things that people could use to try to help reduce some of those pressures that they have in terms of being able to afford meat.
One thing that I just saw that might be slightly off topic, but I saw that as of the new year, milk is going to be more fortified with vitamin D. Who can tell me about that?
Already fortified.
So that is a new requirement that they're actually putting on milk, and it might impact some consumer purchasing behaviors. We do have this already in effect for more plant-based dairy products, and they're usually fortified with vitamin D or protein. And we do see these requirements. So some of these changes that we see across the supply chain, sometimes this additional pressure or this additional activity that needs to take place to add that vitamin D means that the price is going to be higher. There needs to be repackaging to reflect that there is vitamin D. So that might either squeeze the margins for the producers, or it will reflect in the final price, which means that milk is going to be more expensive for consumers.
Well, I mean, milk is highly controlled, and Rose, speaking of that, milk is really expensive.
Yeah, milk is expensive as well. It's really challenging for families today. You know, again, you're going to go to other dairy sources like yogurt, certain cheeses, cottage cheese. You know, you're going to try to look for alternatives for this. But the fact is that everything's going up, and 25% of households today are considered insecure in terms of their food. And my concern is people going to the ultra-processed foods, which sometimes can be cheaper. So they'll be eating more junk, which is not good for their nutrition as well.
Absolutely. We're just about out of time. Dr. Molai, last 20 seconds to you.
Yeah, I just wanted to highlight the fact that what we are looking at, food price is just one factor in a whole system. And food security is a matter of national security. So we have to really think about it beyond the food items themselves and think about how we can have a more resilient system for consumers.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Thanks so much, Dr. Sadaf Molai and Rose Reisman. Everybody have a good weekend, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Libby. Take care. Okay. Be well. Bye-bye.
Okay, people, that's all the time we have Free for All Friday coming up tomorrow. And I always love to talk about food, especially as we head into the weekend. So I'd like to hear about your fixes. Also, a lot of other things that came out this week. We had a lot of court cases being thrown out because they were taking too long, including murders and rapes. We have a proposed tax on real estate just for the upper end. Is Olivia Chow mumdanifying Toronto more than it already is? So all those things. Give us a shout tomorrow. That's all the time we have for Fight Back with Libby Znaimer for today. Follow us on YouTube, Instagram, and I'll be back here tomorrow, and we'll talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.